Okay, thank you, Alec. So at first, I would also like to take the opportunity and thank the organizers for setting up this marvelous meeting and for inviting me. It has been a very productive and interesting stay. And right away to start, as Oleg already noted, probably the most important slide of this whole talk is this one here. And so I was told to aggressively advertise this. And so the next, see this thing is on. Yeah, it's on. So the next highly frustrated magnetism conference is going to be in Braunschweig, which is a place roughly located here in Germany. Berlin is somewhere up here, and Frankfurt is somewhere down here. So wherever you touch down, there are brief train connections to this place. And if you want to pre-register, please log on to the site. The pre-registration is open, and we need registration as early as possible to see how we are going with the number of people. Okay, so the content of this talk is as announced. I will be focusing on the role of defects in quantum magnets, and the somewhat vague subtitle was meant to highlight that the systems are rather distinct in the sense that one of them is a quantum critical system, which is completely unfrustrated, but which has defects in it. And the other one is a frustrated magnet. And again, we are going to look to the role of defects in these two systems. So the defects are somehow the tie between those two systems that I want to focus on. But the role that they play in those two systems are very different, as I hope will get clear as we go along. So to begin, let me also thank my collaborators here. This is in Braunschweig, a PhD student of mine, and from the University of Auckland, George Martins. So the first part of the talk is tied to the collaboration with Simon, and the second part of the talk is tied to collaboration with George, and we get some funding from the German Science Foundation. Okay, so let me jump right into the topic of the first part of this talk, the interest in studying the role of defects in such systems, as I will describe in going along, is related to experiments, which you can find on, well, dimer magnets in the sense of this thallium copper chloride, where you have a strongly tightly bound spin 1/2 dimers formed from copper sites, and there are some three-dimensional couplings in this system. I don't want to go too much into detail on that. The main point is that you can pressurize those materials, and if you pressurize them, they, at least to my understanding, are one of the very nice examples where you can actually have this scenario of a quantum critical point tuned by an external parameter. So you pressurize, change the coupling constants in the system, and you go from a state which is actually spin gapped at low pressure, ambient pressure, to a state which then has long-range order at high pressure, though. So, and you have a quantum critical point here. This is determined from resonance experiments, the spin gap. So this is really like you see the spin gap going down in the system and closing at that pressure. Yeah. So now this is, so the system has a critical point which is accessible, but quantum critical point which is accessible. But in addition, you can go and dope with defects. So you can put in non-magnetic defects replacing the copper. And then what you see is that all of a sudden, in the gap, formerly gap phase, the material starts to develop long-range order at some finite temperature. So you get order from doping the system with non-magnetic impurities. So before going into a model that we like to study here, which has some relation to such materials, let me just briefly and very sketchy tell you what kind of disorder you might want to dream up in such systems. And there may be many others, but I just want to just set the scene here. And probably the most commonly studied type of disorder in such systems would be to analyze bond disorder, and you are very well aware of the fact that then you can integrate our singlets, get random singlet phases, Griffith phases, anomalous exponents, depending on the type of models that you look at. And this is an issue which has been studied for quite a while now by many people, and I'm not going to go into this topic. The second thing, which is maybe experimentally more relevant, as I've shown just, is taking out sites, so really doping the system with non-magnetic impurities like shown here. And this has been studied in the context of spin ladder systems for quite a while, some time ago. And then finally, also in such dimer magnets, there is a conceptually very interesting type of disorder that you could dream about, namely taking out dimers. In that case, you can go to the percolating cluster, but you can still have the system critical, because the driving force of the quantum criticality, namely the dimer coupling, just remains completely intact. So then you mix classical percolation with quantum criticality, and that might, at least on particular models, might lead to new universality classes, which have been studied by some people. But from an experimental point of view, it's not really clear if you can realize such kind of a disorder in such a system. But anyway, it, conceptually, it's interesting. So for the remainder of the talk, I actually want to focus on this type of disorder. Okay. So now I have to specify the model that we're going to look at, which is the so-called two-dimensional Kondo necklace system. So it's not a 3D system, so all the phase transitions will happen at zero temperature, but at least it's sufficient to get phase transitions. And the name necklace simply stems from the fact that these systems have been studied first in one dimension, where then you really have like a necklace dangling with dimers. And so this is a term which has not been dubbed by me, but just comes from the literature. So the Hamiltonian then is a spin model with dimers dangling on a 2D plane with exchange links. And it's a one-parameter model, just by means of, say, the dimer exchange being the parameter that you drive. It has some relation, obviously, to the actual Kondo insulator systems. If you think about the 2D lattice here being a lattice of electrons at half filling with strong Coulomb correlations in the plane, and then obviously this Hamiltonian is just the strong coupling expansion of the planar SD model at half filling with large Coulomb correlations in the conduction band, therefore the name Kondo necklace. And it has been studied in the context of Kondo insulators, actually, also. So now in the first part, so to speak, of this first portion of the talk, I want to show you about the quantum critical properties of this model as we tune the on-dimer exchange. And in the second portion of the talk, I want to discuss what happens if we dilute the system, taking out some of the spins on the dimers, always focusing on the top layer, so to speak, which I frequently call the Kondo sites, because in some sense those are the moments which relate to the Kondo sites in the SD model. Okay? So just a very brief remark on the method we use. I'm not going to go into any detail on that, not to bore you with that. We are using, for this first portion of the talk, I'm using a numerical method, the quantum Monte Carlo technique, by means of the stochastic series expansion of the partition function. So for those of you which are unfamiliar with that, just think plainly of a high-temperature series expansion of the partition function, which is done such that the error of this expansion is down to the numerical accuracy of your sampling. So essentially, you converge these expansions to whatever degree of precision you like. The system sizes that you can treat for for clean systems, or for non-disordered systems, or that we at least treat, go up to 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 quantum sites, so spin 1/2, and we usually excess temperatures down to a beta of say 200 or 300, usually never necessary, but in principle it can be done. For the disordered case, life gets a little bit more complicated, because now you have to combine the quantum equilibration with the classical sampling of the disordered system, and that makes life a little more complicated. So usually all the results that I'll be showing you up until the very last slides where we look at finite size scaling of the disordered case are done with on the average of 1,000 or so of impurity realizations, plus including on the order of 10 to the 3 or so quantum spins. And the temperatures in that case have to be far lower than the temperatures usually used in the clean systems, and I will show why that is necessary. So here the inverse temperatures are really down to very low values of beta on the order of 1,000. Okay, so let me just right away start and show you some results on the clean system. So what we compute is the static structure factor, and in principle also the static susceptibility at the antiferromagnetic wave vector, but I'll come to the static susceptibility a little later. The main point is that, so here I'm just showing some typical examples. These are, so to speak, then the order parameters of the magnetic state, both for just the conduction, so to speak, plane layer, the complete system, and what I call the impurity or condensate layer. And you see all of those structure factors obviously dive at one particular value of a critical coupling. And this is done for one system size, this is done for a different system size, this is done for some low temperature, this is done for some other low temperature. The main point I want to make here in this view graph is that the actual critical value that you get for the coupling constant, or maybe I should say, obviously from this you see that the system is in an ordered state below some critical coupling J, and is quantum disordered or dimerized above this state. So we have no additional transition above JC. So this is exactly this quantum critical point that we are looking for. And the additional message is that the actual location here of the critical point above system sizes of, say, 24 or 30 by 30 sites essentially is independent of the system size. You still get some change in the order of magnitude of the order parameter, but since I don't want to go too much into the scaling of the transition here, the main message is that you have a critical point at roughly an on-dimer coupling of 1.4. And for example, if you go and look at the new exponent of that transition, you, assuming already that we have a universality class of the nonlinear sigma model, which I still have to show you, we would get a new exponent somewhere around 0.7, which is consistent with 3D Heisenberg universality. That nicely fits into what you would expect from such a quantum model for looking at its quantum critical transition. Okay, so apart from just scanning the exchange coupling constant on the dimer, we can place ourselves right at criticality, which is of course a little more interesting, and look at the temperature dependence of the susceptibilities at criticality. And one of the quantities you may want to look at is the uniform susceptibility. So in two dimensions, and assuming that the dynamical critical exponents is 1, you should get linear T scaling of the uniform susceptibility. So let's check that. So here's a wide parameter scan, first over also a very large range of temperatures for the uniform susceptibility, both in the in the ordered phase, so the curves go like that, the on-dimer exchange is low on top, so you're essentially in the ordered phase, and as you crank up J, you go down to those curves at the bottom here. So you have a saturation of the susceptibility, which essentially is in the ordered state. Now, in the gap phase, you have an exponential drop of the uniform susceptibility, and on this log scale, well, it just dies forever. That's clear. Now, in between, somewhere around criticality, you have, well, something happening that you would like to look at somewhat more closely. So what I'm now doing is I'm blowing up this region here. I'm plotting it on a linear scale. Now, this plot shows several things which I would like to discuss. First, you see a bunch of numerical data points, and usually for quantum Monte Carlo you expect error bars or something like that. There are error bars in this plot. The error bars are just smaller than the symbol size. So regarding statistical error, this is essentially an exact result. The second thing is, usually you would like to see a finite size scaling analysis of such data. So the point is that we do this, and all the curves that you see here are already converged to the thermodynamic limit. So this has no statistical error and is converged to the thermodynamic limit. The scaling to the thermodynamic limit is just shown for the lowest temperature point. So what we do usually is we go like from 24 by 24 to 50 by 50 to 100 by 100 sites, and we just see what happens to the data points as we crank up system size. And once we are saturated, we stop. So usually these curves are taken for, say, 100 by 100 lattice sites, meaning 10 to the 4 quantum spins, and getting these results. So this is the first message. So essentially these curves are exact for the system that we look at. The second message is there is a guide to the eye through these data points. Obviously the uniform susceptibility cannot get negative. It's just telling you that here you are already in the gapped phase and you would expect some exponential downturn at the low temperatures. And somewhere in between, between the 0.093 and the 0.140, you hit criticality, and that's where you should expect the linear slope going through Kaya view. And if you look closely, you see that it's not really completely linear. Even at these rather modest values of the temperature compared to the on-dimeric coupling, which tells you that there are already nonlinear corrections to.
This model have a particularly small quantum critical region for some temperature?
Why? This is a good point. Probably it's due to these dangling spins on top of the layer. So in my understanding, there is just one additional study of this linear regime that is done for the bilayer Heisenberg. And that was exactly, so your question is exactly to what this common down here is. So there's one study by Anders Sandvik and collaborators for the bilayer. And for the bilayer, which so to speak couples both the spins on top and on the bottom, also in a plane direction, the linear region is larger. And obviously we can also look at the bilayer, which we have done, and for that model then we find a larger region of linearity. So currently what we're trying to do is we're just trying to do perturbation theory with some DIMA models on this region to see if there are particularly large corrections to quantum criticality, which may stem from the local moment, which essentially just is dangling to this point. So maybe that gives larger corrections. Presently, this is just a finding from this analysis. Okay.
The slope of that linear term is also supposed to be reversible when you use the velocity and some other quantity.
Right. But I mean, yeah. That is okay. Yeah. Well, if you go low enough, the point is just we don't really know what to do with the square term. Yeah. No, sure. I mean, but that's a good point. Yeah. You can go much further in comparing to what a continuum model would tell you. And obviously, we have done all that. I just wanted to show you here that it seems that the quantum critical regime for this model is not as large as for the bilayer Heisenberg. Okay. So now there's another interesting quantity which relates to the quantum criticality of that system. And this is a rather busy slide, so I want to walk you through that slowly. It relates to the so-called Chakravarti-Halperin-Nelson ratio, which is essentially a ratio of the staggered structure factor to the staggered susceptibility. If you have a purely classical system, then you know from thermodynamics that the ratio of the two guys should just go like the temperature. So the whole ratio is just a constant, namely 1. So both deeply in the ordered phase, which can be described classically in terms of order parameter modes, or very high up at high temperatures where the system is essentially a bunch of free spins, you should expect this ratio to go to unity. So you see that it does. There are small differences, which are finite size effects. So this curve is done on a 24 by 24 system. If you crank up, so the system size is shown here. If you crank up, this little difference to the one just goes down. Okay. Now, if you go into the gapped phase, then both of those guys go exponential. So they divide out and the thing goes like 1 over the temperature. So you should expect this thing to go like 1 over temperature, which it does. You can also see that there are, in this plot, you have errors. The reason is simply that you divide two quantities, so that is where you get nonlinear error propagation in the QMC, and you need to care more for statistics. Now, most interesting, obviously, is when you start to go into the critical regime. Now, in the critical regime, you see rather large finite size effects, in the sense that if you take one and the same on-dimer coupling, but you vary the system size, say from 24 to 50 or from 24 to 50 to 100, then the very low temperature points vary strongly. And that has a very simple reason, which has nothing to do with the criticality of the system, but which is related to this fact here. So the system has some very small finite size gaps still. And if you start hitting that temperature range, you will always end up with a 1 over T. And so if you go low enough in temperatures, you will always start picking up the 1 over T from the yet existing finite size gaps of the system. And therefore, at the very low temperatures in this regime, you have to watch out what system sizes you want to look at to get convergence of the data. So the main point is now, if you go to large enough systems and place yourself with the exchange coupling constant at the critical point, this thing essentially levels off at a number, which is around 1.1. And there are claims from the continuum models that this number should be somewhere between, well, the claims from the nonlinear sigma model is that the number should be 109. And, well, I think 101 is close enough to say that this fits with nicely in with continuum model results. Okay, so much for the clean system. Now let me come to the role of defects. In a nutshell, this is all that we get on the low temperature behavior of the uniform susceptibility with impurities. And I will extend a little bit on these results as I go along. But the first thing that you immediately see is, well, once you are in the gap phase, say above criticality in the spin gap phase, and you compare the uniform susceptibility of the clean system with that which has defects, you see what every experimentalist would immediately tell you, why are you doing these calculations? I mean, you get a Curie tail, right? So we get a Curie tail, right? Actually, you can look at this on a log-log scale, and you see, yeah, it's linear. So you have a Curie tail. But I'm trying to convince you later on that in this Curie tail, there is some physics which is at least interesting, at least to my understanding. So let's look at the uniform susceptibility in the disordered phase. The simplest approximation that you could make, which obviously is not sufficient, is to consider the system such that every impurity that you put in induces a free local moment. Right? This cannot be right, because the free local moments will somehow interact if you go low enough in temperatures. But at least one can do that and compare to the results from the Monte Carlo. So in that case, you would just add the Monte Carlo for a clean system reduced by the number of impurities and add in a bunch of Curie constants for a number proportional to the concentration of them. These would be such dashed curves, like so, for the product of the uniform susceptibility times T. That is done for these three concentrations from 3% up to 20%. And now you compare that to the results from the Monte Carlo, and you can immediately see that, let's take the largest impurity concentration, which is 20%. So comparing this very trivial model with the actual results from the QMC, that the Curie constant seems to creep down as you lower the temperature to very low temperatures, like beta is 1000, and it is far lower than the Curie constant of just counting the number of free spins system. So that's essentially said here. So the temperature dependence of the Curie constant is there, and it is lower. Now there's a an easygoing scaling argument for that, which is due to Furusaki and Siklist. The main point here is that what counts for evaluating the susceptibility is the total spin squared, so to speak, of your system, averaged over the impurity configurations that you have. So if you go low enough in temperatures, you will start building patches of local moments interacting with each other. And simply by random walk, you can, and by Marshall's theorem, you can calculate the total spin of such a cluster to be obviously proportional to the number of dopants, but with a universal factor of 1 over 4, which simply comes from binomial or random walk arguments. So if you take the typical total spin squared of such clusters and then plug them into the elementary susceptibility formula for a local moment of a particular size, you immediately realize that there's a difference of a factor of 1 over 3 with respect to simply counting the impurities and multiplying them by the Curie constant of a spin 1/2. So there's a renormalization of a factor of 1 over 3 of the Curie constant in that system as compared to simply counting the impurities. So this reasoning can be checked simply by looking at the chi times t product in our system. And we have done that here in the gapped phase for various impurity concentrations, which I'm showing here, and various coupling constants. So at the lowest impurity constant, so this line here is the Curie constant, which you would get simply by counting the impurities. This is the Curie constant which you would get by multiplying by 1 over 3. So now you check for the chi times t product, and you see that for the lowest concentrations, we still seem to be not low enough in temperatures. Those curves are still leveling off, but one can already see that they will probably level off at the value which is clearly not 1, which is lower than 1. So if we are at 10%, you can clearly see that all of those curves essentially level off at one number. So it seems to be, so it's less than 1. It seems to be more or less independent of J. And it tends to more or less approach this number of 1 over 3. But if you look at this as a function of the concentration, you see that there is a general trend of the data going down. So apart from the fact that there is this renormalization of the Curie constant by this factor, if you crank up impurity concentration beyond the small doping limit, you seem to have a systematic downturn of this Curie constant, and that can be understood rather easily. I mean, if you take away all spins in the upper layer, then you're back with the planar Heisenberg model. And the planar Heisenberg model has a finite uniform susceptibility at zero temperature, so the chi times t product should just be zero. So therefore, if you crank up the concentration, you expect that this guy just goes down to zero at concentration 1. So in summary, yes, there is this renormalization of the Curie constant. And
the argument, Siklist's argument, that should be for dilute limit?
Should be for the dilute limit, I guess so. I mean, it's a.
Is it supposed to be an exact argument or?
From considering how you do the derivation, I would say it is rather exact. So you just need to have a system with a gap, and you need to dilute it. And you need the only thing that you need is okay. I should be more careful. The thing that you need is that you are low enough in temperatures so that the cluster size of the spins that are talking to each other on the average is large enough to apply, say, central limit theorem. If you are at very high temperatures where the spins essentially do not talk to each other, you can still consider them as being more or less free. So it depends on the coupling strength. I mean, they do second, fourth, and so on order correlations via the occupied dimers. And so it depends on the J's, the effective J's, between those emptied sides. And so at very high temperatures, you will still see, but then you have a problem because you have not leveled off. So that, I think, accounts for this creeping down of the chi times t product. And once the size of the blobs of spins that interact is large enough, then I think this argument is pretty universal. So once the size hits the system boundary, which may happen at very low temperatures, then again the story may be different. But as long as you have these effective spin clusters, I think the argument is pretty rigid.
So there's some, you would think you have to go to lower temperatures and worry about.
Yes, that's scaling. Right, and that's why I think we have this issue here. Yeah. So I think we should need to even go to even lower temperatures with.
How does this temperature to which you want to go?
That's a good question. I mean, we should know this. Right. So I mean, it probably would. And this would then also set, I mean, limits to such simulations. Okay, the J's are given here.
They're never deeply dimerized.
Well, no. Obviously, if you make... okay. This would be an additional way to do it. I mean, you can just make the effective coupling between the J's very, very small, right? That you could also do. And by that, you can push down the temperature at which they start talking. Yeah, sure. Not sure. And in some sense... So in some sense, you can see this also from the data. I mean, if you look here, which of the guys settles off earliest, that's the one with the smallest J. Yeah? And so you exactly see that the one with the largest J takes the longest time to go down. Yeah? But you can also get a feeling roughly from such plots how much really changing J affects. So you should really go to very large J to get those guys just going like that and then coming down. So probably, yeah.
This argument only for bipartite systems or also any gap system?
No. I think So we have one of the inventors in the audience, and But anyway, yeah. So it goes. You need the bipartite lattice, yeah. So because you use Marshall's theorem to count on what you get for the imbalance. So from the imbalance of the depletion, you take the total spin number, and therefore you need an AB sublattice structure. I think at least to simply carry out this argument. And as you will see later on, I mean, for the frustrated systems, the role of the defects are completely different. Okay. So this is just maybe I just skipped this slide. This is just a word of caution because usually from experimentalists, I immediately get this point that. Well, but if you dope an antiferromagnet, you don't get a Curie tail. That's obviously true. I mean, you need to have a finite correlation length and a spin gap to see that. And you will only see Curie tails on a scale of the finite size gaps in the ordered phase, and that is just shown here. So if you go below the critical point, then there's only a tiny region, which is essentially in temperature space, which is essentially set by the finite size gaps, where you then actually see... uniform susceptibilities which have a Curie tail. So obviously all we are discussing it works in the gapped phase. Okay, so I can be very brief on that view graph. So apart from looking at the Curie constant of the uniform susceptibility, obviously for any given impurity configuration, fixed impurity configurations, you're going to develop anti-ferromagnetic correlations on the lattice, since the lattice is unfrustrated. So you expect to see order developing in the system. And then obviously you can run averaging over impurity configurations, but that will not change this reasoning. So you expect the dopants to induce long-range magnetic order in the gapped phase. And we can do that by simply looking at the order parameter as a function of the exchange coupling constant for various doping strength. And again, we use this 3%, 10%, 20% numbers. And as you see, well, this is the quantum critical point. And starting with some finite doping of 3%, it seems like that the order parameter levels off and doesn't want to go to zero. Now, you immediately can argue that maybe these are all finite size effects, and I will make a comment to that. Just for the time being, these plots clearly show that seem to show that the quantum critical point is more or less immediately destroyed by starting to dope the system. And you can also look at that from a different point of view, namely slicing through these plots at fixed J. And you see some variation of the order parameter then as a function of concentration. And you can clearly see that if you get close to criticality, then there's a rather sharp drop of the order parameter as a function of the concentration. So it may very well be that there are some power laws or interesting universal phenomena going on that criticality regarding the concentration dependence of the order parameter, but I'm not aware of that results exist. So at least here, these QMC data seem to suggest that there is something going on. For us, it is very complicated to tune ourselves exactly at criticality to see how this thing works out, at least on a finite lattice. Now, just one remark to the quantitative effects of finite size scaling. So you could immediately argue, well, all these finite magnetizations that you see in the doped state are finite size effects. And so now what one has to do is to discourage such arguments is to take, say, one concentration curve, and apart from doing the quantum and the impurity averaging, also to do finite size scaling, which is kind of costly. And so what we have done is we have done this for one particular concentration, namely the 10% concentration, and we have studied what you see here, the values of the order parameter as a function of inverse system size going up to 10 to the 4 times 2 lattice sites and then extrapolating to the thermodynamic limit. And the main message that you can take away from this plot is that there's always a finite order parameter for all those J values above criticality once the system is doped. And if you translate that into the extrapolation, this extrapolation here, into the order parameter picture on that side, you see that you get these kinds of quantitative shifts going from the 24 by 24 to the infinite system size. So we think that the impurity concentration in that system is really a critical quantity. There is no finite concentration that you need to destroy the order parameter. You could still argue that maybe you have to go even lower than 10%, but then there is no reason why you should expect 3% or 1% to be a special number in that system. I mean, this is already way below 2D percolation, so it's clear that we think that the concentration is critical in this system. So maybe I skip this here. This was just to tell you that. Okay, so the conclusion to the first part then is that we think that this 2D quantum necklace model has a quantum critical point that is consistent with a nonlinear sigma model and has a critical coupling constant of roughly 1.4, and that the side dilution of this system shows a low temperature free spin clusters to develop, which have a renormalized Curie constant, different from just counting the number of spins by a factor of 1 over 3, which is consistent with earlier investigations on spin ladder systems. And we think that the critical coupling, that the critical concentration of defects in that system to drive the system ordered is just zero. Okay? So if there are no further questions, I would just readily jump on to the next topic, which is the effects of defects in a geometrically frustrated system, which is this so-called bowtie ladder system. So a bowtie ladder is shown here. And to be more specific, a bowtie ladder is this geometrically frustrated 1D lattice structure of corner-sharing triangles. And this system has been looked upon in the past in different ways. People have studied spin models on this lattice structure, in particular these people. And what they have found is that the system is very similar to the Kagome, but also distinct in the sense that the number of singlets that you find below the first triplet in that system does not scale exponentially with system size, but rather seems to scale like a power law. But nevertheless, you have a large number of singlets below the first triplet also in that system. There are still issues, many unsolved issues about this system regarding the size of the triplet gap, and I'll comment on that later. People have also studied hardcore dimers on that system, using, however, plain hardcore dimer models with short-range resonating moves. So just looking at the shortest loop exchange between the dimers. And for example, one interesting result here along that line was obtained by Grégoire in his squish. And he has shown that this model, just including the short-range dimer moves, boils down to the transverse field icing chain at criticality and can then solve the exact. Now, our approach here in this part was very different. We wanted to understand to what degree you can take the short-range resonating valence bond bases, quote-unquote, serious, and get some properties right in the sense that they compare to the properties of the actual spin model on the lattice. So we are not focusing on, say, only short-range resonating valence bond moves. We just want to take the dimers as a variational basis and look at that. And obviously, this is a very dangerous game because the dimension of the Hilbert space of the spin system kills you exponentially as compared to the dimension of the dimer subspace. And already on rather modest system sizes, like 36 sites, the relative dimension of the Hilbert spaces is just almost zero. And therefore, our approach is not what you should... Our approach is to look at the dimer subspace both from the point of view of thermodynamics and a little bit of ground state properties, and then from the basis of correlation functions, and compare results for the spin sector and the dimer sector and see if we can make anything out of that. In principle, we should compare the set of first low-lying states in these systems and see if there's a one-to-one correspondence which between those two states, and then we should also look if the overlaps between the states in the dimer system and the states of the spin system scale exponentially or algebraically as system size goes to infinity. But that obviously we cannot do because the systems are just too small. Okay, so what I will do in the remaining time is I will first look at some thermodynamics, and then actually I will look at the effect of impurities, which is the actual desire in this second part of the talk. So just again, one brief slide to what we are doing technically. Obviously, we're doing exact anglization there on one side. There is nothing much to say about that. And from the analytic side, we're just calculating matrix elements within the dimer base using Ruma graph expansions, so transition graph expansions to get matrix elements. So that is a technique that we apply, and we do not only take into account short range loops, but we take into account all loops that are possible on this model and all topological sectors that are available, so just any matrix element that could eventually come into play. So here's something on the ground state energy. So you have to solve the generalized eigenvalue problem in the dimer subspace and compare that with exact analyzation. So first, this is on a blown up scale, and there you can already see that. So we also have a 36 site point here. I don't know why this is not on the graph. I just forgot. So essentially, there's again slight upturn here. And if we extrapolate to the infinite system size limit, the zero is not on this plot. Obviously, we get something like a 4% difference of the ground state energies between the dimer subspace and the exact analyzation. That is already not very small. Yeah. I mean, it's a sizable difference between the two ground state energies. If you want to understand, or if you want to look at this on a larger scale, you can also, for example, look at what quantum fluctuations actually do in the system, and first trimerize this chain, which we have also done, and then study the evolution of the ground state energy as a function of the trimerization ratio. And then you see that these are typically the shifts that you get between the trimerized state, in which the dimer basis is an exact ground state of the system, and the fully interacting, so to speak, fluctuating system, in which the dimer basis is obviously not an exact basis anymore. And you see these are the kinds of shifts that you get between the exact diagonalization of the spin model and the dimer, so to speak, expansion of the Hilbert space. Okay? Now, another quantity.
What does that tell you, actually?
That just tells you that the ground state energy is not. That doesn't tell you a lot about.
The dimers have a virtual mixing with the non-dimers, obviously.
Right. I'll come to that. And I will tell you something about the specific heat also. Maybe that makes things a little more clear. It's just usually people want to look at the ground state energy, and so I'm just telling you what the ground state energy is. I think that what you should actually do is you should go and take the low energy excitations of the dimer system, the low energy excitations of the spin system. You should see, say, starting from the trimerized limit, if you have adiabatic continuity in some sense, and then to check the overlap. And that is just a project which we are trying to follow currently, but which we haven't completed. So, yeah. But this just tells you the ground state energy is not completely off. Yeah. I think at least that it tells you, definitely. So now we want to look at not only ground state, but also at excited states. And one way to do that is to look at the specific heat. So what we do, what I show first, is the specific heat that you get within the dimer bases. For systems, I should. Did the wrong way here. For systems up to 36 sites. Now, what you see from this plot is that, say, starting at already like 30 sites or so, the dimer space on the system has essentially exhausted the specific heat up at temperatures above, say, a tenth or so of the characteristic energy scale of the system, so no finite size effects anymore. Obviously, there are large finite size effects below that. Yeah. I'm coming to that. I just first show you the dimers.
Yeah. Only the dimers,
and to tell you that, say, above, say, a tenth or so of the energy scale of the system, 36 sites are sufficient to not get any finite size effects anymore in the dimer bases. Below that, obviously, we have finite size effects. So now, the finite size effects at low temperature are huge, right? But that is in a sense, no cause for panic, because what we are going to do now is we're going to compare exact ionization using the complete space and exact ionization using the dimer bases. Right? And that we do for 12 sites, for 18 sites, for 30 sites, and we put in some DMRG calculations by these people, which go down to a temperature like that. So this again shows the specific heat as a function of temperature, and what I want to convey with these pictures is that obviously in the high temperature regime, where the system has lots of triplet excitations, the dimer space cannot help you, it's clear. But in the low temperature...
Right.
In the low temperature regime, that is what we want to focus on, you see that there's somehow a striking resemblance between the data on the complete spin model and the data that you get just using the dimer space. And even structures at higher temperatures have some similarity, but you shouldn't take that too serious because you should see that this is a log scale. So there's a lot of entropy up here, which you don't capture. But down here, the absolute magnitude is comparable, and so a lot of the entropy actually comes from the short range resonating dimers, which fluctuate on the lattice. So from that we conclude, or at least we claim, that it seems that this low temperature peak, which is here and which is also in the Kagome, is actually related to these short-range resonating dimer fluctuations. At least that is a hint to that. And so with that, we now go one step further and look at what happens if you put in impurities in this system. And obviously the role of impurities, so this is just a hand waving, a reasoning of what impurities would do to you in such a system. So without impurities, you have strong fluctuations of dimers around the triangles in these systems, all with more or less equal amplitude. And if you punch a hole, so if you put in a defect, the physics is very different now, because in a sense, the defect relieves the frustration. So the defect will start to bind a dimer. And this leads to a reduction of the low energy singlet fluctuations in the system. And that is very different from what you'd expect and what I've told you from the first part of the talk, and somehow also relates to the first part of the talk at this point. Namely, on systems which have essentially some kind of valence bond type of correlations in them, if you punch a hole there, you will localize a free moment close to the hole, and that will lead to low energy triplet excitations. Now, obviously, this is just hand waving, and we can try to quantify that. So how do we quantify that? We take the system, first with exact ionization, and due to technical reasons, which I think are irrelevant at this point, we take an even number of sides and two holes instead of an odd number of sides and one hole. And so on this graph, you see the number of singlet states as a function of energy. These are those curves going up. And you also see the energy of the first excited triplet on that system. And so you see it for zero holes, and you see it for two holes. And so, first of all, you see that once you introduce the hole, you have a strong reduction of the number of singlets. That's obviously, you will get the strong number of reduction over the whole energy scale of the system. But that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that the triplet location is almost unaffected by introducing the holes, while if you count the number of singlets which you actually lose by introducing the hole, you see that the number of singlets you lose below the first triplet is quite large as compared to the number of holes that you have punched. So that somehow goes hand in hand with the notion that once you put in defects, you reduce the low energy number of singlets, say, or the low energy singlet fluctuations in the system. Okay? Now, obviously, you can look at that kind of calculation also in the dimer subspace, but there it doesn't tell you too much because you don't have a triplet. So at least it's nice to look at that and see that in some sense the singlet curves behave similar. You just suppress the number of singlets at low energies in the system. And I should also mention that this is consistent with results which have been obtained on the Kagome, doping the Kagome, so the Kagome lattice. So now, once we believe that the hole kind of binds singlets, we can look at the at this more directly by looking at local dimer correlations on this bowtie ladder once we introduce holes. And that is shown here for a particular system size. We also have that for others, but I just have it now here for this system. So what that shows is the system with two holes, both on the leg or in the center of this ladder, and the thickness of the lines is telling you on the size of the on-bond dimer correlations. And so you already see here that obviously once you put a hole here, the dimer correlations along the chain get very inhomogeneous, and that the dimers seem to localize close to the hole. Now we can be more specific more about that by making cuts to such a thing, which is just a graphical depiction, and really looking at plots of the dimer correlation function as we go along the chain. So I first do this for this upper case of having the holes on the leg. Now this graph shows two things. It shows the on-dimer singlet correlations, or the on-bond singlet correlations, both taken from the dimer calculation and from the exact dimerization. And you see that they are almost identical. So it seems with this kind of a quantity, the dimer space does a rather good job. So exact dimerization and dimer calculations are very similar. And the same thing happens if you look at what happens if you put the defects in the chain. And obviously there are always places where there are no correlations because this is where the hole resides. Now, if you believe that there is some agreement between the exact dimerization and what happens in the dimer calculations, you can get bold and just do the same calculation for a larger system, which is accessible by the dimer subspace, but not by the spin subspace anymore. And that is shown on the next view graph, just that you get a feeling of what would happen now if you place the holes, the defects on the system, and start to move them apart, like if they would have kinetic energy or something like that. Yeah? And you can look at the polarization of the dimer background are induced from the defects. And you can clearly see, again on this plot, that the singlet correlations are strongly inhomogeneous, and in particular get very large if the holes are starting to be apart a certain distance. Yeah? So it's like a Friedel oscillation of the spin of the dimer background that you introduce by doing these holes. Now, once one believes that, okay, I should point out that there are regions where you can get even ferromagnetic correlations, but I don't know if this is really, it's just a detail. So once you believe that this is the physics of what happens to the spin correlations with defects, you can ask yourself about the hole-hole interaction in such a model. And there's a simple geometric argument to what you should expect, namely, you want to maximize the number of dimers close to the defect. And to do so, you have to move them apart a certain distance. And obviously this distance is different from depending where you put the holes, so geometry may play a role here. It's different for being in the center or on the legs of the chain. So now we look at this comparing the exact dimerization and the dimer calculations. So this is for the two defects placed in the center of the system, and this is for the defects placed along the leg of the system. So the two curves now relate to either taking the exact ionization or taking the quantum dimers, and what you see is the energy, so to speak, of the two-particle state as you move the two particles apart. And you can clearly see that there's an obvious minimum in this two-particle potential. For example, for the defects on the center of the leg, once you move them those three sides apart, which they need to build the maximum number of dimers close to them. And then when you continue, well, you seem to get oscillations. Now again, for the exact ionization, we are stuck here at 30 spins. The reason for that is once you have defects in the system, the translational invariance of the system is gone. Usually that is one of the major symmetries you want to use to diagonalize exactly. So if we take clean systems, we can go up to 36 sites, which is not a problem. But once you put in two impurities, you are lacking translational invariance. So this is a bottleneck to the system size that we can reach. So, but since the agreement is not that bad, we again can go one step further and use the dimer expansion to just go a little bit further what we can do with dimer expansions. And so that is, yeah, again, this is very similar to what people find on the Kagome, just to mention. Now we can use the dimer expansion to go somewhat further and to ask, what about confinement, so to speak, on this system? Now, just to remember or remind you, if you would have a state with valence bond correlations of this type, like on a spin ladder, and you start separating holes, you get a linear confining string type of potential. Right? And obviously, you have confinement of the excitations then also. Now, on our system, if we now go to a system which has 14 bow ties, which means that you can move the particles at least 7 bow ties apart, and then periodic boundary conditions start to hit you. So you can at least take them 7 sides apart. You can clearly see that there is this kind of oscillatory. So these many curves are just for the number of systems sizes, and the largest then has like 42 sites on which we do the dimer calculation, and that is the lowest curve here, which has this oscillatory behavior. And you can see that the holes, as they are separated, at least on the scale of this system, do not have a linear confining potential in some sense, but some oscillatory type of potential which is related to them. And it's clear, I think, from this that on this system you would have scattering states of two particles, and the particles would deconfine, and there would be no confinement on that state. So in summary of the second portion of the talk, what I have tried to convince you of is that these short-range resonating valence states are at least conceptually interesting to study some aspects of the complete spin model. They may not capture all of the physics, but some aspects they do. So they seem to have some interpretation power in understanding the specific heat, and hole-hole correlations, and spin correlations and interactions. And I haven't told you that also for some dynamic correlation functions, they seem to be an interesting candidate. And obviously, as Rajiv pointed out, one would like to know more about the specific connections of the excited states of the spin model and the dimer model, so to speak, and we are working on that. So with that, I would like to conclude and thank you for your attention.
So do you know what happens to the magnetic susceptibility in this case of, again, the second part of your talk? You have no magnetic impurities, you have traceably low temperature.
in principle, we could have analyzed that from intensity with thermodynamics. I mean, most certainly, I should be cautious, I would not expect such curry tales, that this could be consistent with the fact that we don't see any low energy triplet excitations once you start doping the system. So I would not expect a dramatic change at low temperatures with doping the system, which is very different, so to speak, from the first part, where immediately you pile up low energy excitations in the gap once you dope. So I think there's a difference. That's a good point. And one should simply look at the sensitivity. We haven't done that.
It may be interesting also because of this compound that is covered sometimes.
Yeah.
It has some. Yeah. It has two kinds of impurities. One of them is this non-magnetic.
In principle, I think it should be. Yeah, it's actually not really a problem because I mean we just kind of look at the data, we just didn't do it. That's a good point. Yes.
Any other questions? Let's thank you for our study.